the photons beyond the point where they don't just go right through the bubble, it's kind of easy to break them, I guess. So there seems to be, I think, some mechanical complications that just limit your ability to do any of these things.
See, with a completely different line of thought.
Yeah, certainly.
Well, what I think, let me have it, within we force on the object, so let's say laser radiation pressure. For the mass of weight that we have force on it, if we, let's say, put, I'm trying to get a quick calculation from A, M equal P divided by C times G, that would be, for the power of 1 watt, it comes to 0.3 micrograms. That would be the mass that could be affected by the laser beam as the radiation pressure for the on an object and to exchange.
But even in the best case, that's assuming that you're getting absorption of those photons. If those photons are just passing by, they're not going to impart any momentum.
How do you know they are passing by? Did you measure the energy of the photon coming into the an object and energy of a photon leaving an object?
Soap bubbles in general, and these in particular, appear to basically let the light through. There is, at times, reflection coming from them because, you know, it's kind of a impedance mismatch almost. You get reflections off of the bubble and such. You get refractions. But as far as absorption, soap bubbles, again, are pretty much transparent and very, very thin. So I don't think you're going to get that much absorption of the photons at the soap bubble. If you did, you'd probably rupture the soap bubble.
We're not talking about any one of that. You have a refraction. Let's say we don't have it. Let's say for the moment we don't have it. You have a reflection. Let's say we don't have it. Let's say we have a waveguide. But the light is entrapped in the bubble and goes partially to the surface of the bubble and to exchange.
Okay, but then you'd have to kind of make up this entire theory of optical tracking of laser beams through the membrane of a soap bubble that I don't think you can come up with, because I don't think it happens.
So what is your explanation?
Well, we'll get to it in a moment. One gentleman called out a completely different thought. What's your completely different thought?
Okay, this is WB2KWC. Could this be a parlor trick, a complete fake? Essentially, you've got your laser beam, and coaxially with that, pointing in the same direction as a gentle beam of air, the motion of the bubble, the effect on the bubble, is simply due to this air, and the laser beam is completely irrelevant to the discussion.
That is an excellent idea, Ken. And it approaches what's going on, but it's not quite identical. If it probably would be a pain in the backside. I mean, think of it. There's some guy beneath this guy blowing air at a balloon in time with him flicking his laser beam at it. So the coordination, you know, you had to give these guys points if that's how they did that.
It is the internet, after all.
My question is, would enough convection exist sufficiently far from the laser to negate the bubble momentum and repel it before it hits the laser? So, I don't know if there is a study on it, on convection in intensity distribution. I have no idea. and to exceed.
Well, the convection is, as I said, was a good idea. Ken had a good idea there. It's just that it would probably be inconvenient to do it that way, simply because it's doable, I guess. But you'd need to coordinate it with someone underneath you. And I'm presupposing Ken's idea is basically has nothing to do with the laser. There's a guy underneath with some blowing air, what have you. The canned air that we were talking earlier in regard to Joe's question about the little expander. And, just to kind of keep the bubble popping when it's put near the laser beam, so it gives you the optical illusion that the laser beam is bouncing it. I think that's what Ken is going after.
Well, what actually puzzles me is that I've got that article, http://gonature.com/3710CVF, and that talks about researchers who create branched, slow phenomenon, invisible light in the bubble, in the soap bubble. And that actually for me is a phenomenon that talks about the surface of the bubble acting as a waveguide. And it's a truly scientific observation. Maybe that has something to do with it. And we're talking about branch flow.
Well, it would be interesting if it turned out to be something like that. And I want to thank everyone who volunteered. I think the guy who pretty much came incredibly close to it is Ken. It is basically a fraud. It is basically nonsense. What happened was, and it was much easier than just having some guy below him blowing air. He basically just strung a piece of transparent fishing line from one end of his laser pointer to a shelf on the other side, and it wasn't the laser beam that was bouncing the soap, it was the fishing line.
What can you expect from such illusionist?
Yes, well, I hope you guys appreciated this one. It's a little bit unusual. I usually kind of point out things that don't sound right but are right, and this is a case of just something completely nonsensical. I will also post a YouTube. There are some very clever guys who saw the Ukrainians' video and decided that even if it was nonsense, it was worth their trouble to try and reproduce it. And instead of using a fishing line, one of the gentlemen decided to use some invisible thread that he had available that basically serves the same purpose. So I hope you enjoy kind of thinking these things through. Occasionally these things are real, but a lot of times they're make-believe. And so, we have to accept that for what it is. But all you guys had very clever ideas about how this might be possible. So I thank you all.
If you don't mind, I have a few scientific news.
Okay, try and keep it concise because we're moving into a Paul's time period.
One is from the area of genetics. UK-based company planned to, and that is already happening, purposely release hundreds of millions of genetically modified mosquitoes into Florida. It looks like science fiction story, but it has received approval from authorities. Insects combating tech company called Oxitec, 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 has created a male mosquito modified so that all of its offspring died before hatching. Those male mosquito have additional gene that makes females who bite die. So they actually make the eggs, but nothing hatches out of it. And it's called OX5034. In Florida, there will be 750 million of OX5034 that will be released, and they have already approval of EPA and approval from Florida agencies, seven Florida agencies, and that will be, I believe, this fall. The project is still seeking approval from a few other agencies, but it looks like they're going to have it. Now, I see in BBC that there are the people who are opposing it, I'm thinking who is responsible for that motion. Maybe some of the guys who make money on spraying from the airplanes. And I don't believe that that's less intoxicating than actually releasing those mosquitoes. Let me drop. We have another story, which is X. Well, the X Prize is non-profit global leader in designing and implementing of innovative competition models to solve world greatest challenges. And a number of competitions, the Lunar X Prize is 20 million, COSIA Carbon X Prize is 15 million, Global Learning X Prize is 10 million, Avatar X Prize is 7 million, Shell Ocean Discovery, and that's what I'm going to talk about it, is 7 million. And Barbara and Built Literacy X Prize is 5 million. IBM Watson XI for more information. Okay, whatever, I've read that. So what is happening? The X Prize announced 9 remaining competitors for round 2 for undersea drones. And they will have a capture of an image of a specially named item for 4,000 meters. So 4,000 times 3, so it's 12,000 feet deep in the ocean for archaeological, geological, and biological features. And 2 days ago I saw BBC showing unmanned vehicles that were in that competition without anything but electronics, self-powered. They could stay for a very long time in the ocean, taking all the measurements and necessary experiments. There is another one, and it's the last one. Elon Musk unrevealed not so little pig, one that and from his brain, and the other one that had an implanted interface that was connected to the computer. It was Gertrude. Sniffing the ground and eating while loud beeps and bleeps filled the air and display showed real-time spikes in her brain activity. Musk explained that Gertrude had the implant inserted in her head 2 months before and that is connected to the neurons in her snout. When she touched something with her snout, it sent out neural spikes or... Let me jump. protected by more than 1,000 electrodes in the implant. What he's thinking about disabled people, not really about the people who are naturally able to move and perform, but people with certain deficiencies, and that's what his technology is directed at. But I'm curious, Dr. Roy, what is your comment on it, on those brain-machine interfaces? And to exchange.
AC2GS. Okay. Elon Musk. Elon Musk is a self-promoting guy, has a lot of money, has some knowledge, but he also knows that the best route is hire the best people. So he hired a bunch of rocket scientists, and they made rockets. He bought his Tesla design from the original people, and he hired a bunch of engineers to tweak it and improve it. Somewhere along the line, it kind of got blurry of how much was Elon Musk and how much was all the smart PhDs out there doing all the work. So in addition to things like the Bohr machine that never really paid off, or the loop that never really seems to pay off, and a bunch of other things, is this weird thing about him wanting to build a chair that automatically gives you brain surgery, which I have a problem with on so many different interesting levels. It basically just puts a little patch of an array of electrodes that are basically about 1,000, and if you put a potential through them, sometimes something happens. If you look for a potential, sometimes something happens. I think it's a lot more spin than it is reality. The ultimate promise, supposedly, is mind-body computer interfaces. And we're about as far away from that as almost humanly possible. There are so many incredible things that have to be done before we can get there, that these are just kind of shows. This is just photo ops, as far as I'm concerned. But I tend to be a skeptic about such things.
How about your comment on mosquitoes, modified mosquitoes?
This is not the first time they came up with ideas like this. In the past, what they were doing was irradiating male mosquitoes and sending sterile male mosquitoes to fail at reproducing with females and block it that way. Which is, I think, unfortunately, much easier to sell to people to have irradiated mosquitoes rather than genetically engineered mosquitoes. When you start to talk about genetic engineering, you get a whole group of people who get very, very upset and worried that we're going to have monsters and all kinds of strange things occur. You know, in the old days, it was a radioactive mosquito would bite you and you'd turn into Mosquito Man. Now I guess it's a genetically engineered mosquito bites you, and you turn into something else. I don't know. So although the people who make a lot of money by spraying are going to be against it and will probably give money to crowds of very worried normal human beings who get worried very easily, I can see this being a big public relations problem.
Well, something is falling in your head, and you have no control over it. And it's not decided by you, it is decided by some authorities. And you don't know what is the chemical structure or chemical content of that what is being thrown on your head. Thank you, John. Now, you have a genetically modified mosquito that was approved by the agencies, and now it's ready to be released. And also, there was a number of very much positive tests. One was in South America, and that was in Brazil, where population of mosquitoes dropped down of 97% because of use of those genetically modified mosquitoes. Question. Which weather scenario would you like to see? The one with falling stuff on your head and you have no idea when and where and why? Or actually, the other one, enter ship.
KC2GS. Well, for all intents and purposes, I'm not that terribly concerned about genetically engineered designs. Thankfully, we don't know that much to do anything terribly bad, so most likely this is going to be very innocuous. And as I mentioned years ago, mosquitoes are probably the cause of more human deaths each year than any other animal in the world. Lions, alligators, crocodiles, pale by comparison to the millions of people that are killed by malaria and other parasites that are transmitted via mosquitoes. So a good mosquito is a dead mosquito in my book.
Thank you very much for your comments. If there are any other comments, I would love to hear it.
Okay, I want to remind everyone before the SpaceNet report that if you have any questions, topics, puzzles, the email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. And a link to the link page, which will include a very funny YouTube of these guys faking the soap bubble and the laser beam, is going to be available at roy.ac2gs.com. And as always, there is Mike KC2NJI's archives going back to September of 2006 at amateurradio.tv. So I want to thank people who participated tonight. I hope you kind of enjoyed the puzzler. One of them, the laser beam, red, green, and blue, had a real reason, and the other one was kind of an April Fool's version. So thank you very much, and I'd like to turn it over to Paul, WS2N, with the SpaceNet report.
Thanks, Roy. AC2GS, WS2N, and very good. And I can't help but thinking that these mosquitoes are going to somehow change the environment down in Florida, and we're going to wind up with 100-foot alligators somehow. Interesting. And that's usually what happens, you know. You tinker with things and then, oh, look what happened. Why do we have two-headed alligators or something? Well, we changed the mosquito. Very good. Okay, well, we have another launch coming at the end of the month. Not too many important launches coming up this month, but one at the end of the month is the Cygnus Antares launch on September 29th. And that'll be 10:26 p.m. at night. So we should be able to see the launch from Long Island or high up building maybe in the city. You look to the southwest. And that would be our Cygnus cargo vehicle going to the International Space Station being launched by an Antares rocket. All done now by Northrop Grumman. You know, a couple of years ago, Northrop Grumman bought up Orbital ATK, which used to do that work. So we'll stay up for it, 10:30 at night. But not that much happening during September. October, of course, you have the International Space Station. You're going to have a crew going up on the 14th and a crew coming back down 1 week later, which will still allow three people on board. You have three on now, you have three up for a week, and you'll have a total of six, and then they'll come down, back down to three. But then soon after that, SpaceX plans on launching a crew of four ham radio operators to the International Space Station. And then you'll have a crew of seven on a regular basis for the first time. That should be great. Let me just drop it. Okay, I talk about SpaceX Starship program. That's the one that they plan on going to Mars with eventually. And in the interim, they might use it to go to the moon. The Starship program has been underway for quite a few years. SpaceX very successful with their Falcon 9 rocket. They now send cargo on a regular basis to the space station. They send now crews to the International Space Station, all on the Falcon 9 rocket. They've launched telescopes, space telescopes on that thing. They've launched all kinds of different satellites to different countries. They're very successful, but they're building the Starship down in Boca Chica, Texas. And I always like to keep track on how they're doing. They're up to around 9 Starships that are under construction of one way or another. The first 3 or 4 were destroyed from testing. And the Starship itself is really the second stage of a bigger rocket called the Super Heavy. The Starship right now is at the point where they're testing to see if they can fly it off the launch pad 150 meters up, roughly 500 feet up, and then they translate over a couple hundred feet, and then they come back down onto a landing pad. They've done this once successfully, beginning of August, with what they call SN5, Starship number 5. That worked out good, and they want to perfect it. They want to look at the landing legs that open. They want to look at the telemetry coming back. As they do this, as they test and progress as time goes on. So they built another one pretty much identical to SN5 called SN6, and sure enough, a couple of days ago, I did get to see that go up in Boca Chica, Texas, right near Brownsville. You can always bring up a YouTube on it and put an SN6 150-meter hop, and I'm sure that will pop up. There's one group in Lab Padre, which is near a couple of miles away from that facility. They have long telescopic lenses, and they just constantly film on a regular basis, and they have people talking when there is a flight, a test flight. But it's interesting. He's doing good. He's got a couple of other Starships that he's presently building. Once they do a couple of tests between SN5 and SN6, a couple more of these hops. Elon Musk plans on moving on to not SN7. SN7 is another Starship vehicle, but they're using that for testing. They're just going to pump it up with a tremendous amount of pressure to find out what it could take. It's now made out of a more modern or an upgraded stainless steel. These things are all made of stainless steel. They look like stainless steel silos right now because they don't have a conical cone on top, and they don't have wings yet. But SN8 and SN9 will. Putting a cone on top to bring in the total height of the Starship to around 160 feet. And it's also going to be 30 feet in diameter, filled up with liquid methane, liquid oxygen. And once they get to SN8 and SN9, which should be before the end of the year, those two rockets will be going up quite high to around 20 kilometers or 12 miles high. Which, of course, over twice the height of where an airplane would fly. So the air is quite thin up there. I think you have 90% of the air is, it's very, very thin, maybe 10% left. So it's not quite space, but it's getting close to where he wants to duplicate a re-entry of one of these things. You can imagine getting this 160-foot 30-foot diameter with he'll attach 3 of these Raptor engines. Right now he's only attaching 1, but he'll attach 3 to get it up to that height, and then he'll shut the engines off, and then he'll let the front end tilt forward. Front end, the top will have little wings on it, the back end will have wings on it as well. It's not going to come in like a shuttle, It's not going to come in, like, you know, with wheels or anything. The idea is to come down vertically. But to come through the atmosphere, he's going to have heat tiles on one side, heat-resistant tiles made of pica, called Pica Rex. And it'll come through the atmosphere. The surface will get heated up. Or somebody that jumped out of an airplane and they're floating down that way, you know, belly first. And then as it gets closer to the ground, they've got nitrogen rockets to or reorient this thing. The back end will come straight down. The engines will reignite and hopefully land back at Boca Chica, Texas, where it took off from. And, of course, if that's successful, they'll do that, you know, quite a few times. And the ultimate goal is to put one of these things, of course, into orbit. So, but, you know, the development right now, it's like buying a stainless steel silo, and then for number 8, number 9, it will look more like a Starship. This is WS2N. Any questions or comments before I go on?
I have a question, partially related. When you start to talk about Mars, could you go to the double lake phenomena and intermittent liquid water flowing energy?
Mars. For SpaceX, that's a ways off, Wesley. But, of course, we're there now. And there's another 3 rockets on the way, 3 spacecraft on the way now to Mars. So, you know, one by United Arab Emirates called Hope. Another one by China. They have an orbiter and a lander. And we have one that's on the way called Perseverance, the 2020 rover. But we'll get to that, Wesley. Let me just go through a couple of these topics before it gets any later, okay? Okay, China just launched a rocket, of course, from China. And they launched it on a Long March 2. Long March 2 is the one that they would normally use for launching a crew vehicle, which, of course, China has launched crews into space before. They've been doing that every now and then since, 2003. But they did launch another vehicle. They didn't make any announcements to the public. It turned out it was one of these top-secret launches. And what it is a reusable vehicle. They put it on top of the Long March 2, launched up in space, and it has wings on it. And they didn't even know how long it was going to take to come down. Showed up 2 days later, they come back down and land. There's no pictures of it. It's all top secret. They'll probably use it as a spy vehicle. But, there have been pictures of what the reporters think it does look like to see. They saw one being manufactured a couple of years ago, so they know what it looks like. And when you look at it, it looks like an almost duplicate to Boeing's X-37B. X-37B is an American spy plane or spy spaceship that's launched by the United States. It's gone up roughly, I think, 4 times on a Atlas V, and at one time SpaceX put it onto a Falcon 9. And when they launch it, it's got wings and the fairings open up. They put it into space and it stays up, not for months, but sometimes for years. So it's doing its spy work. It's got all thrusters. It's able to, these ion thrusters, and it can move around in orbit. So eventually, ours comes back. We've been doing this since 2010. Right before the last space shuttle, it was retired. It was the first launch. I think we're up to the 6th launch now. We have 2 of these vehicles, the X-37B. And they come down in their first two landings. They came down in California in Vandenberg Air Force Base. We have pictures of that. So it's a spy satellite. And then they refurbish it. They'll send up the other one while the other one gets refurbished. And they started off, you know, 6 month flights, and then, you know, 1 year flights. I think the last one was like almost a 2 year flight, over 700 days on one of the vehicles. But to look at the China, what they did, it looks like an exact duplicate of the X-37B, which is a shame, and I don't know how they could have possibly. Somebody must have just, like, called them up and gave them the plans or something. Here's what you're doing. Here's some pictures or something. Who could have done that? But that's what's going on with China. And it looks like they could probably eventually develop the thing for a manned flight as well. This is WS2N. Any questions or comments? Okay, James Webb Space Telescope, which we've been talking about for many years, and back K2RIW loved that topic. He really wished the thing could have gone up on time back in 2017, but it still hasn't been launched, and here we are in 2020, and it won't be launched until October 21st of next year, 2021. But they're moving along finally. They've had a lot of problems. Prices has escalated. I think they're up to around $10 billion on this thing. The goal is to put it into an L2 location, Lagrange Point 2. So just one update on it. Anyway, they've tested a lot of things on board. They've tested the sun shield, which is as big as a tennis court. They've tested the 21-foot diameter gold-plated beryllium mirror that they'll use for James Webb Space Telescope. You know, that's an origami type of setup. The whole thing is those mirrors, roughly one meter hexagonal mirrors, will all be folded up and then expanded in orbit, as well as the sun shield. But the first thing to be unfurled is going to be this 20-foot solar panel. So it's a five panels make up the solar panel. And the reason for it is, you know, right after launch, you're on battery power. So everything depends on that. You get this thing up to speed. First thing, solar panel. Has the capability of delivering 2 kilowatts to the spacecraft. And because they plan on using this for 5 years, 10 years, and you know, hopefully to keep it going as long as possible, like they did with Hubble, at some point the solar panels tend to degrade, and they think it would eventually go down to 1 kilowatt of power. But that's all they need, 1 kilowatt of power, to run everything on, you know, the cryogenics and everything that they, you know, that they need on James Webb. So the panels were installed last week, which is a good sign. And they've tested it many times to make sure they could open up and close properly. So this thing's all going to be compressed and put on top of a Ariane 5 rocket down in French Guiana, you know, down in South America, Kourou Launch Facility. And Ariane 5 is the biggest rocket European Space Agency launches at this time. They do launch a Soyuz rocket that they buy from Russia for medium payloads, and then for light payloads, and now the Vega rocket. So that's the story on that. I just had to give an update on best one. Okay, now here's a, you know, I'll get back to more serious topics in a second, but I had to go cover this one. This has to do with the story about this guy. His goal was always to hang on to helium balloons and, you know, just float off the ground. He thought about it when he was very young. This guy's name, he's David Blaine. I don't know if you've ever seen this guy on TV. He was on TV a lot more years ago. He would do a lot of magic in the streets. He comes out of Brooklyn, New York, so did a lot of magic from, you know, an illusionist type of guy. And then when he got older, he got more famous. He was doing a lot of stunts that, you know, were pretty risky. You know, he'd bury himself or put himself in a block of ice and see how long he could last without eating, and all these bizarre things. But he got away from that over the years. I think he realized that he sooner or later is going to kill himself. David Blaine, I saw the video on this. When I first saw it, I figured, well, this is going to be a joke, but it turns out CNN had it, a couple of other reputable news agencies had it, and they had basically a whole story. You could go onto YouTube now and see how this guy did this. And he got a hold of a crew, and he's been working on this for about a year. And sure enough, he's got these pink and purple type of balloons. He's really doing it for his daughter. He's got a young daughter. He wanted to impress his daughter. He put together 52 of these balloons, and you know, they showed the lift of each balloon has the capability of around 17 pounds lift. That gives him, you know, around 800 pounds lift on these balloons. But when he took off, he just took off, you know, lightly. I mean, just barely. And the reason you need the 800-pound lift, he's got weights attached to him. As he was going up, he was able to drop weights, and then he was able to accelerate higher, faster. He also has a parachute that was tied to the balloons that he was able to eventually pull down and put onto himself. So that parachute, I think, weighed around 180 pounds. It wasn't a real parachute. It was a paraglider. This way, when he got up to altitude and he wanted to disconnect, he could disconnect and float down. This all happened out in Arizona somewhere. And sure enough, he accomplished what he was doing. He got up to, they kept showing the altitude. He got up to 25,000 feet, so 5 miles high. He did have an oxygen tank up there with him, so he was able to breathe oxygen. It looked like he was well-dressed, heavy-duty clothes on him. I guess he probably had some kind of heaters in there, probably electric heaters. They didn't say. And he did have bare hands. You can see that. He had one of those oxygen meters he was able to put onto his hands. A couple of cameras coming down from these 52 balloons. And they videotaped the whole, you know, him and him talking to control. So it was pretty good. It was pretty cool. Sure enough, he successfully made it down to the ground. You could always put in David Blaine, balloon flight, and you can bring up probably a gazillion videos on it. What I had trouble finding was any still pictures, because I did this right after this happened. I did find a still picture to send to Dr. Roy on roy.acqgs.com. You can go there and see this guy's hanging from the bottom of these 52 balloons. And it's quite an accomplishment. I mean, I've seen weird things like this before. Years ago, some guy went up in a chair or something, and it was a BB gun. But this is really impressive. He got way up there. You know, you could think the cameras were looking down and everything, and to get up to 5 miles high, that's way up there. And then disconnect. And then he fell until, I think they said 7,000 feet. He opens up his paraglider to come down and land. Any questions about David Blaine? This is Brooklyn. Nothing like a New Yorker to do something like this. This is WS2N. Any comments?
WB2EAV.
KD2FIU.
It's BB first, and then I heard George.
Going up to 25,000 feet, targets to air traffic. That could have been disastrous.
Oh, yeah. I mean, this guy's been planning this for a year. They have a... they cleared it with the FAA. He's out in Arizona. He's, you know, he didn't come out of the backyard and just take off, you know? But, yeah. They even made a comment, a couple of comments. He's going as high as where the airplanes go. George, over to you, WS2N.
Yeah, thank you, Paul. I heard this of this about 6 weeks ago, five, 6 weeks ago, and I was happy for you to mention it because I wanted to bring it up on one of your nets. I don't know if it was Blaine, but they were talking about 25,000 feet, and the success of it was going to actually hope to deliver in the future rides for people who wanted to pay for this. And of course, the ride is not simple. It's going to be extremely controlled, as you're mentioning, oxygen and equipment for thermal care and all of this. But I heard of this about 6 or 7 weeks ago, and thank you for bringing it up, Paul.
Okay, I wonder if we're talking about two different things. This guy's got 52 balloons. I mean, big. No, I mean, it's pretty incredible. It's not one big massive balloon. There is a company called Paragon out in Arizona also, and they're developing a crew vehicle that could eventually put six people in a vehicle that will be able to be lifted off from the ground with this massive balloon, you know, thousands of feet in diameter. And it would take you up to the stratosphere, 25 miles high. Not 20 miles high. But this guy went up 25,000 feet. No helmet, no nothing. I wonder if what you're talking about, Paragon, where you go inside this crew vehicle, pressurized and everything. You go up, nice flight. You see the curvature of the Earth up 20 miles high, and then they would release, and then you would. That was the original plan. They would release, and you would come down on a parasail, the whole crew vehicle. Now they've changed that thought to actually coming back down on the balloon. Back to you, George. KD2FYU, WS2N.
Thank you for explaining the difference, Paul. The second one that you were mentioning is what I did here, but this is incredible. It's still like it's 100-year technology, 100-year-old technology, and we're still taking advantage of it. And thank you for explaining the difference. KD2FIU, I'll be on the side.
Okay. You got to go over to, like I said, I had a hard time finding a picture. I guess you can probably find him now. But if you go over to roy.ac2gs.com, he's got the picture posted on his website. All these colorful balloons with this guy dangling from the bottom. When he first is doing it, you know, I'm looking at it, and he's hanging on with one hand and saying there's no way in the world he's going to hang on and take off and hang on for, you know, an hour. The whole flight took him around an hour and a half to do this. No way you're going to hang on. And then after watching him for a while, I realized he's attached. It's coming down, attaching to his body. And he's just reaching up, holding it. It looks like he's holding the balloon. That was the deal on that. I didn't get why he had to, like, lower this lanyard and put his parachute on, or parasail, onto his body in flight. That was kind of weird. I mean, I would have just had that on him in the beginning. But he, you know, he's into stunts and everything. This is what this guy does. He's quite a character. So
that time.
There you go. I had to bring that up for the net. No, it's not rocket related, but it's pretty bizarre. Any other questions? WS2F. Yes, go ahead, Wes.
If you were to be asked why it was 52 balloons, not one big blimp, and you were to think, what was the possible reason behind that? What would be your answer?
What's possible behind what he did? I mean, he does tricks. Get away from it, like. Back to you, Wesley. Not sure the question.
Now, from physical standpoint, Dr. Roy, would you like to help me out to properly word my question? I believe you understood it.
Okay, you're talking about the physical situation. Well, yeah, he had one of those oxygen meters, you know, when you go to the hospital or the doctor, they put the, Dr. Roy's probably saying, but you know the name of it, it's a big long name. Yeah, an oxygen meter attached to his finger, and they kept putting that up to the camera. He's got a camera attached to his body, and they could read that, asking him how he feels, and he had the oxygen tank that he was able to breathe through. So, okay, the other station, now I forgot the suffix of the call. Go ahead.
WB2EAV, you mean me?
Okay, you're a little low, but I can hear you. Go ahead.
I can talk louder. In World War II, the B-17 and B-20 were unpressurized at 25,000. It's a tremendous history on the biology. It was the cold, and this was all resolved in World War II.
Okay, well, this guy, he duplicated that at 25,000 feet. They show him breathing, you know, he was doing good. He practiced a lot, they said. He went down to Antarctica, and he did a lot of physical things to keep himself, get himself ready for this. So, that's what happened. They had naturally medical people asking them this and asking him that during the flight. And he, you know, he was in good shape when he landed. I mean, you know, he landed upright. He did plenty of practice. I don't know how many parachute jumps this guy made. He had this real expert guy teaching him how to do this, how to parachute from 5 miles up, you know, how to open up. And it wasn't just a regular parachute. These are parasails. So he was able to guide himself into a location, which he did. And then the helicopter came right down and picked him up and brought him back, you know, wherever he took off from, which was, like, very close. And there was hardly any wind, you could tell, because this guy did not drift far. You know, he just kept going higher and higher and higher. So, okay, any questions before I move on? This is WS2N.
What I think is there was a 52 balloons, because if some of them had a failure, he still would have a few left to slow down his fall down, even though he has a parachute on him. Do you agree with that? That's why he used so many balloons instead of one big limb contusion.
Okay. It all started because, you know, he's an entertainer. What I wanted to do was grab a bunch of helium balloons when I was a kid and take off. It started off that way. But yeah, I'm sure you're right. You know, with 52 balloons, he's got plenty of backup. And I did the math real quick, was 17 pounds. They showed this, you know, they did have a scale of 17-pound lift on each balloon. It was around 800 pounds with all the heavy equipment he had on his body, and the parachute, I think, it weighed around 180 pounds. It's not a regular parachute, it's a parasail. They're heavier than the parachutes. The oxygen tank set up, poles coming out with cameras all over it. You know, and then he was carrying a lot of weights attached to him. And then he was being very careful. When he dropped these weights, he would check with the control before he did. You know, he didn't want this to come down and hit a car or something. Cause he wasn't too far from a main road in Arizona. Anyway, let me just move on before I'm starting to run out of time here. I just want to mention this Rocket Lab company. They fly the Electron rocket. About a month or so ago, they had a failure with one of the electronic components going uphill. The electronic component disconnected. It lost some connections between some vital pieces of equipment, including the impellers. The impellers on the Electron rocket are run by electricity and motors. 50 horsepower motors and lithium-ion batteries. So you know it has 9 engines on the Electron rocket. Each engine, they're called Rutherford engines. You name them after Rutherford. And each engine is supplied by electric power to run these turbines. You know, instead of your conventional rocket that you would normally fly, which you know uses pressure from ignition from combustion to run your turbines. This you know he's changed that to all electric power. He's able to have much lighter plumbing involved and much lighter rocket, and he's able to launch rocket after rocket. I think this was his 14th launch inside of like a year and a half or so. So it was successful. He changed out his upper vacuum-capable Rutherford engine. But then what's equivalent to the kick stage is the Curie engine, which he used to put all the payloads on, and the Curie engine would turn around and burn itself back up in the atmosphere. Now he's done away with the Curie stage and put what he calls the photon stage on, which is essentially a satellite. You know, so it's got locations for all kinds of different pieces of equipment, CubeSats, whatever you want to put on. So he's got a location for that. Now he can charge customers even less money to launch their payloads into space by having his own satellite. So that was successful. And he's got the okay now from the FAA in the United States to launch from the United States. He's been launching from New Zealand. That's his main location. He launches on the North Island of New Zealand. He built a launch complex there, and that's where he launched all his rockets from. But now he's built a launch complex near where Northrop Grumman launches the Cygnus Antares rocket that I talked about in the beginning. He took another launch complex, and he's going to be launching from there probably within a couple of months. I wouldn't be surprised for the first test from the States. He's registered in the United States. His name is Peter Beck, and he's headquartered in California. So now he'll be able to launch in from Virginia, from Wallace Island, and then on top of that, he's got so many customers on his manifest that he went ahead and built another complex in in New Zealand as well, so he'll have three launch complexes to launch all his rockets. And not to be outdone, he plans on eventually having the first stage anyway be reusable. That's going to be coming down through the atmosphere. I think on number 17, so he's up to, what, 14 now. So around three or four more from now, he'll have a booster come down through the atmosphere.